But it came up for discussion in those days.
Did you buy the argument, and I quote, concerning the arrow, the decision not to proceed in February 20, 1959, that when it was undertaken in 1952, it was estimated there would be a need for a more advanced manned interceptor of this type to meet the bomber threat that was expected to develop by 1958. It is now considered that the threat of the manned bomber is not as great as was originally anticipated. Furthermore, this by 1962, when the CF-105 would have come into operational use in the RCAF, the main threat is expected to consist of long-range missiles rather than manned bombers, period.
Yes, but you'll recall in recent days the SALT discussions are not devoted entirely to missiles. There's the question of the
backfire bomber.
Backfire bomber still very much alive. The standoff missile that's still very active in Strategic Air Command's inventory, and here we are, late 1979. So go back 20 years, and
do you think technology maybe, or at least the not knowing technology and assuming that all these new wonder toys, whatever they are, would come in faster, obviously much faster than they anticipated, and by quite a few years. Because it was unknown, or is this just purely rationale to get rid of the Avro because of the cost?
Oh, I think it was. I think it was a little of all of that, but the principal burden was financial, and they were finding as many arguments to rationalize the enormous cost down the drain. That mm-hmm. it was a political requirement to come up with a fully developed all-purpose
Canadian built.
No, but an all-purpose argument to explain the loss of millions and millions. And I can understand the political need for something like that. But if, I repeat, 20 years later, we're still with a substantial man force.
Still looking for the arrow.
and we're still looking for something
to put
into the inventory that will meet the threat. And the threat still remains, granted, strategic deterrence largely composed of missile forces on both sides, but there's still a very, very large manned air force. Russian-operated, NATO-operated. So those old arguments don't look too good 20 years later.
Well, I think we've done it for today, sir.
Very good.
And if I can come and see you next week, we'll pick up from 5960 on until your retirement.
And try and wrap it up.
Wrap it up and fight off the ever-prevailing unification, of course.
And if you want to make a personal contribution to the Canadian Air Force Equipment Fund, I'll accept it right here.
You've got it. Thank you very much, General Edwards. My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Major General G.J.J. Edwards, DFC, CD. And the date today is 29 August 1979, and we're at General Edwards' home in Saanich. We're on the air. Last time, General Edwards, we got about as far as 5960 and what you were doing at this particular time.
Ooh.
Throw it in your court now.
Okay, all right. In August of 59, I had completed a two-year tour at the RAF Staff College in Bracknell, Berkshire, in England, and then was posted back to Air Transport Command. Again, you may recall before Bracknell I was in Air Transport Command in Lachine, Quebec, as the mm-hmm. senior air staff officer. In the two-year interval, Air Transport Command had completed plans to move its headquarters from Lachine, Quebec to Trenton, Ontario, and I rejoined the headquarters then in September of 59, this time as the deputy commander of Air Transport Command.
Now, would you be a wing commander?
Promoted now to group captain.
Promoted to group captain?
Group captain. Promoted to group... I arrived as a wing commander, and I think was on the job for the better part of a month before my fourth ring came through. And I was with the headquarters in Trenton for 4 years until 1963. They were four particularly active years for ATC, Air Transport Command. Major re-equipment programs underway. Finally replaced the North Star aircraft with the Canada Air-built Yukon, the four-engine turboprop, a Canadian outgrowth of the British Britannia. We're buying C-130s to replace the C-119s in a couple of ATC squadrons, 435 and 436, and at the Operation Training Unit. We bought some new flying boats.
Flying boats as opposed to seaplanes.
As opposed to seaplanes, and these to be used principally in a search and rescue role.
BD amphibian, what would it be like?
Oh, this was the twin engine. We called it the Albert. What the devil was the Albatross? It was. I think it was a Grumman Albatross. We called it the Albert. So those were three new types. Then we were buying smaller passenger aircraft for 412 squadron. The twin-engine turboprop Cosmopolitan was coming online, and we were in the process of buying the twin-engine executive jet. What the devil was it called? French aircraft built by Dassault. The Falcon twin-engine jet.
And that would be for who?
And that was for 412 squadron, and that was an executive jet. That was for what we called the VIP activity of a 412 squadron. So there were five new types of aircraft coming online in that 4 year period I was in Air Transport Command, and we were introducing for the first time really a modern, in Canadian terms, a modern air transport system. The whole with the aircraft, the size of the aircraft, the range of the aircraft, the airlift capacity that these new aircraft now offered, required us to completely modernize the whole ground environment from coast to coast, and indeed, as I'll discuss later, into Europe, the whole range of ground handling equipment to service, load, and unload these aircraft.
Now, the rationale for, like I say, an airlift to Europe to support the brigade that was there and the squadrons that were there.
And the air division.
And the air division.
But what we really did was in that period of 4 years from 59 to 63, we really almost totally reduced our World War II inventory of aircraft. And the aircraft that had come in immediately post World War II.
We're getting rid of all the old
North Stars and Lancasters. We reduced the C-47 Dakota inventory. We had bought the C-119. We discussed that earlier, but the C-119 had a relatively short life. It sort of beat itself to death in the air, if you like, heavy vibration. And we were moving into the turboprop and jet period
for transport and airlift.
For transport and airlift.
Whereas before it was just primarily fighter, I assume.
I'm talking about
jet and prop jet.
The equipment program had, most of it had gone towards air defense, both in Canada and in Europe. They'd gone through the F-86, the CF-100, the 101s and the 104s. absorbing very high percentages of the of the Air Force budget, and we had we in the air transport business had lived through this period with great envy and watched a complete modernization of the combat force, and it certainly made sense. But meanwhile, the air transport and the maritime force had been let go, and had the
now
stuff.
Now it was your turn, I guess.
Now, in a sense, it was very much our turn.
So, what get the premise being that you get your operational fighters
sharp end up,
and then start building the rest of the stick.
Yeah, yeah.
To get them and, efficient as an efficient.
And to provide in the case of Europe an air logistics system.
Well, this is interesting, I find, because recent studies in NATO, and they try it all the time, have finally come to the conclusion that they cannot airlift enough men and equipment fast enough, and that when all is said and done, we're still going to have to rely on ships.
Sure. Sure.
But that's today, and they've I guess are not coming to that conclusion, but if I'm not mistaken, in the 60s, the belief was that men, equipment, things could be airlifted. I think especially the Americans, of course. But there would be enough plane and enough planes and logistics and everything else to get the men and equipment and everything else to Europe if need be, within a couple of days.
I never.
That was the rationale for not having, you know, especially when Canada withdraws, reduces its commitment to NATO. One of the rationales was, well, if there's a step up, we can fire the boys over. And
well, that to my mind, and a lot of my colleagues agree, that was very much that was rationalization.
Just plain rationalization.
Plain rationalization.
So you were never under the delusion that you could airlift.
Never, not in the air transport. We didn't have enough. And the very fundamental question in the event of a major outbreak there, where would you put it? Were your airfields going to survive? Because the air transport force needed a.
Who would have air superiority as well?
You'd certainly have to have air superiority. But if they threw a couple of missiles at the airfields that we were required to use because the specific ground handling equipment was there. We may have been able to find an airfield, but how would we unload the damn things if you didn't have the forklifts and the heavy loaders and the whole transport apparatus that must be on the ground environment to make a modern air transport system work.
So you were never under any illusion that the air transport could relieve, or not relieve, but
we knew the capacity. We knew what our airlift capacity would be. And it fell significantly short of support for a sustained operation in Europe. If the stuff wasn't there,
mm-hmm.
we weren't going to be able to make the difference. A major sea lift was certainly required. But in any pre-hostile activity where a build-up was necessary, although a build-up might have contributed to a higher state of tension. We knew we could fly in filler forces. We knew, for instance, that we could we were committed to a northern flank operation. We could get the Canadian contribution if airfields existed in the area. We could get the Canadian contribution in terms of people and basic equipment. But to sustain a high intensity wartime activity, it was out of the question. And,
what about the civil carriers in Canada? Was there a contingency plan to, say, commandeer Air Canada aircraft and, say, CP Air and the other large airlines in Canada?
ATC worked very closely with what they called MATS in those days, Military Air Transport Service, run by the United States Air Force. And the Americans had a very definite plan with their commercial operators. And the commercial operators were required to cooperate by law. They had a full range of specific contingency plans fully approved at the necessary government level. We did not have that. we talked regularly with, I guess it was Air Canada by then, Air Canada, CP Air, and so on. But we could never come to grips with a positive, specific plan. We knew that in the event of an emergency, with War Measures Act, say, brought into play, that the commercial carriers would have to cooperate. But the Americans were able to introduce in the construction of their aircraft heavier duty floors to a military standard in aircraft. The size of doors in some of the commercial aircraft were included to military specifications, although the commercial carrier didn't need it for its particular operation. When the machine was being built, these sort of things were put in.
Considerations, yes.
These sort of things were put in. We never did achieve that with our commercial carriers, and to my understanding, to this very day, we still don't have.
Well, the only thing we have going for us, though, is that most of our planes are built in the States, our commercial carrier. I'm thinking of the Boeing and the Lockheeds and the
Each bird comes off the line to a particular company specification. And the company isn't going to spend any more money on that aircraft than is absolutely necessary.
Floors, yeah.
And we would require stronger floors, a rollerized system perhaps in the aircraft. Which are commercial carriers in the passenger carrying side now,
mm-hmm.
Don't have, never did have, and still don't have. But we tried, and mind you, we were a command in the RCF in those days. The sort of thing we're talking about was really an Air Force headquarters responsibility.
Yeah, understandably, but I was just thinking that. You would still have contingency plans, if you will. In the event of X, you have a war book, whatever.
Yeah.
We did.
But it was a pretty loosely constructed plan.
But as you said yourself, though, the War Measures Act would, instead of developing schemes and plans, the War Measures Act would enable you to take what you want.
Yes.
Or what's available, not what you want. What's available.
What's available. We all felt we should have had a more precise contingency plan, because it would have been a pretty hasty development in the event. But we were so preoccupied. Well, that was a problem, and it did concern us. But we were so preoccupied during these four major years in the command to get our equipment online operational, and as I said, to get this Trans-Canada. And really, trans-world air transport system capability going, buying the right equipment. We, for the first time, for instance, in one in Trenton and one in Marville, later in Lahr, we built hotels. When I say built hotels, we took barrack blocks and converted them into hotel-motel complexes. Because we were getting into the airlift of not only the troops, but their wives and families. And
how do you feel about that?
How did we feel about it? Well, we thought it was a very very logical development. It was I won't say it justified the size and the quality of the air transport force, this new air transport force that was being developed, but it certainly allowed us to exercise all components of it, not only with troops but with live bodies, if you like, and the troop movement alone wasn't enough to.
Well, wouldn't it have been simpler and cheaper to and thinking of the Canadian government and austerity concerning the military. Wouldn't it have been cheaper just to use commercial carriers?
Well,
for all aspects of family and things, as opposed to and leaving the Air Force transport to command to purely strategic and logistics.
Yeah, but you see, We heard that argument in those days, and
no, that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, right. Well, you don't invent a sizable air transport system overnight and make it work in an emergency. You need the size of the force that you think you might need to meet a particular sizable emergency. You need the aircraft, the ground handling equipment, the ground crews, and the air crews trained up so that if the thing blows on Monday morning, your guys are all ready to go the previous Friday, sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yes, commercial operators had the capability to lift people, but in those days, for instance, we very soon learned that in the case of the UN action in the Congo, when there was a fair amount of firing going on down around Leopoldville and some of the other bases we used, the commercial carriers weren't at all keen to go in there. So the military air transport force went in, of course. You had to have, we believed, and I still believe, you had to have a force in being sufficiently exercised to be to have a fast reaction capability to meet the meet the needs of the nation.
What about the whole idea, though? We've got back on families in Europe and things. What about having the whole idea of having families over in an operational area? I guess that's as close as we can come to an operational area in Canada is our commitment in Germany, NATO. Why does a corporal and have his wife and four brats running around?
Well, we had
operational or semi-operational unquote area.
Yeah. Well, of course, our other allies right there on the ground, the Germans, the Brits, the Belgians, the Danes, et al. Of course, their families were there. You may recall that the Canadian Army held out for a very long time, and didn't put families in, but they. Or didn't allow families to accompany officially.
Mm-hmm.
The families got over there one way or another, and with all sorts of economic hardship. The RCF early on made a very conscious and positive decision that if a chap is going over, if an airman, officer, or other rank is going over for a 2, 3, or 4 year tour, then in the air division, that. He would go accompanied. That he would perform better with his family there than with his family behind, with all the accompanying worries.
Yeah, you see, I guess the problem that I have with this particular issue is the fact that prior to this, it wasn't a question of going to war. But when you were off, you were off. That was the whole point. That was your commit. The soldier, the airman, whatever's commitment. Talking air here.
Right.
The airman's commitment is
right.
That well, he's on ops or operational. That's to kiss the wife, pat the kid in the head, get in the plane, and go.
That's right.
And then he doesn't have family obligations, so that he can be more. I guess what I'm getting at is the rationale to make them more efficient with their families there, as opposed to not.
Well, Europe as a potential operational theater with forces in, recall the term forces in being in those days,
mm-hmm.
was a particular case. The RCF and indeed the Canadian Army and the Navy were committed to other areas, Cyprus, Congo. We sent some troops over into India, Pakistan
okay.
in their latest war. All of those went, and Israel. All of those went unaccompanied because
they were really operational.
This was a definitely a hot area, and families were not included.
Well, see, I guess what I'm getting at. Yeah, what I'm getting at is that if things did step up in Europe,
we would have had one hell of a problem, and that problem obtains today. We would have one hell of a problem evacuating the families. You know, each Canadian organization.
It's not even a question of officers' families.
I mean, no.
Relatively small number. I mean, private.
The lot.
Private cook.
Well, in those days, we had an air division, as I recall, of some
3,000 or 4,000.
I was going to say five, six. Now, those are 5,000, 6,000 officers, other ranks, officers, senior NCOs, and other ranks. But accompanying them was a gaggle of families that was on an average three times that size. So we're instead of having a force over there of 6,000, we had Canadians to the tune of about 25,000. However, it was you can argue it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Are your troops any better with the families there, or are they worse because their families at home, they're worrying about wives, and wives are worrying husbands about sick children, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
You can argue that one forever, and it's been a military problem forever. We certainly didn't invent it.
No, we used to have the camp followers.
The camp followers.
Perhaps a different.
I wouldn't put families in the same
category. Now we're talking against motherhood. Now, I lost my head for a moment. You remain with Transport Command, initiating new equipment
and systems.
And systems, ground handling capabilities. Did you have to do much work, say, on lengthening runways, things like that, with this new equipment?
Yes, lengthening runways to some extent.
I'm using that as an example.
But more strengthening of tarmacs with much heavier aircraft and parking stands and that sort of thing.
But shops.
Yeah, but it the aircraft, if anything, were getting in one sense less complicated. You know, we're moving away from the ultimate development of the reciprocating engine, which was a pretty complicated machine, into the relatively simple jet turbines. And it was less complicated, and of course better maintenance equipment was becoming available, and we got our share of that.
What about budget and things, though? You weren't given carte blanche by any stretch, but you, as you said, you got the new equipment and things and all it comes with it, so you must have had a lot more money and.
Well, we in the command, you see, didn't see the money. We simply saw the equipment come online, and we were given delivery schedules for arrival of aircraft. When the average person thinks of a new aircraft, you think of just that. Here's a new machine sitting.
Yeah.
And that is perhaps about 25% of the cost. The other 75% is involved in the whole range of
support
and maintenance equipment that goes with it. The whole logistics system now that this new equipment requires to back it up.
Train personnel.
The training of the men. The whole bit. The lead time. The lead time in those days for a modern aircraft, from the time it went on the board until it appeared on your tarmac, was not less than 5 years, and if you expected delivery, say you bought in 1957 and expected delivery in 1961-62, you were worrying about the training of your men as early as 1959-1960, and you were developing training programs for conversion of aircrew and the training up of the ground crew that would service the equipment. They were very exciting, active, and damned long days. And of course, during this came during that period came the missile crisis in Cuba, Congo. We got involved as far away as West Irian in the South Pacific when the Dutch were handing over what was it called before it became West Irian? In any event, it was the handover by the Dutch to the Indonesians.
Mm-hmm.
These are the days of Sukarno, and a UN force went in and an air transport command element composed of otters, float otters on floats, amphibious otters on floats and whales. We flew that equipment down in C-130s and reassembled the otters down in West Irian. Can't remember what it was on Dutch New Guinea. Dutch New Guinea is what it was. Then later by the mm-hmm. Indonesians renamed West to West Irian. And of course we were still in the
Cyprus.
In the United Nations Emergency Force, Cyprus was on the United Nations Emergency Force in Gaza. We had an air transport command unit out there, composed of otters, and later we added caribou to it. Oh, by the way, that was new equipment as well. I mentioned five types earlier: Yukon, Hercules, Cosmopolitan, the Albatross, the Falcon. In addition, we were buying caribou and otters from de Havilland Aircraft in Toronto. And it was with those aircraft that we equipped our air transport unit, 115 ATU, we call it, air transport unit, in Ellerich, in close on the Gaza. And those aircraft in that United Nations Emergency Force provided both airlift of people and logistic support to the UN outposts, but they were also used by UN observers in a reconnaissance role. So I repeat, the 4 years were active ones. I don't think the command before or since has seen a more active period.
Well, it's been a hell of a training ground for you, in the sense of after your staff college training and all your other experiences, to put it all in line as a staff officer.
Yeah. Although it came, I'd been in the air transport business then some before taking up this post in Trenton. I'd been in the transport business for the better part of 6 or 7 years, and knew my way around in it. We had veterans of the air transport game. The RCF Air Transport mm-hmm. Command staff were composed entirely of people who knew what it was all about. So yes, it required coordination and staffing and persuasion and the whole bit. But we had a particularly talented staff at the time, and it went off quite smoothly, really without a serious hiccup. Now, in addition, we were continuing supporting the Canadian Army. The Army was still jumping from our aircraft, the Hercules mostly by now. But shortly to replace the Caribou aircraft we had built by de Havilland, we were getting the turboprop Buffalo coming online as well. So there was another type of aircraft imminently arriving in our mm-hmm. inventory. They were great days. I managed to play a little golf, got my handicap down to about 10, but I when I look back now, I don't know how the hell I did it.
Did it. Where did you go from there, sir, in 62?
63 now.
63?
It was 59 to 63, inclusive 4 years. And then I was posted to the National Defense College as a student from September 63 until July of 64.
Well, how are you getting all this good training? Because, my God, you've been to, you just come back from 2 years at RAF?
Different level entirely. The
this
RAF
to train,
College.
This is for your, what, general officer training? I
this
guess?
Is this National well, Defense College officer. was the senior institution in the military, and NDC of course was not RCF. It was very much tri-service. And in addition to the Canadian services represented, external affairs had students on it, mm-hmm. Other federal departments, RCM police, and we had American and British, both military and civilian, Foreign Office from UK and State Department from US, and it moved you into another, what would I say, sort of the socio-political economic strata.
Pretty rarefied atmosphere.
Yeah, but all all practical stuff, you know, as you moved into more senior positions, you needed to know. You flatly needed to know whereas we were preoccupied in more junior ranks with purely RCF matters and cooperation with Army and Naval forces at the more senior levels. There was a greater political flavor to it. There was certainly an economic flavor, an interdepartmental,
international.
And international. Mm. And this was a fairly in-depth exposure at National Defense College to all of that. And to
now, when you went to that NDC, you would would you form into syndicates? Is that the basis there?
Yeah, syndicate later on became a dirty word at NDC. It had a mafia. It had a mafia connotation. You heard the crime syndicates. They were we changed them later on to study groups, but they were flexible groups, not always composed of the same people, different composition for each main area of study. But 11 months of a different level and a different outlook on the place of the military in the national tapestry, as we called it in those days.
Wasn't a mosaic then?
It wasn't. It was a mosaic with a tapestry flavor.
Flavor, okay.
But they were and a good deal.
Did you pick up your jargonese there, though? I mean, did you get a good course in the catchphrases and words that will enable you to progress and proceed in today's complex society?
You weren't awarded a prize for it, but I suppose inevitably, whatever the jargon of the day was, inescapably you got it there, because we had a very heavy lecture program.
Travel?
And a fair amount of travel throughout Canada. And in those days, I don't think we visited every province. When I went back to NDC later on on the directing staff and finally as commandant, it was a more methodical approach to the study of the Canadian scene. In later days, we visited every province, tried to meet every premier and a host of the ministers. In those days, it was a little less structured, but we traveled.
During this time, sir, we have the whole online progression, if you will, of Hellyer and unification.
Yeah. I remember we at NBC learned about unification in of all places, Peshawar in Pakistan. We were on a world field study into the Far East. And I remember the commandant pulling us all together and saying, now hear this. And it was Hellyer's announcement that unification would take place forthwith. This would be about, I guess it might be as February, March of 1964.
Well, what I'm thinking there is that they didn't sit down and say pros and cons of unification, so they give it as a problem too.
Yeah, we did. We did.
I'm thinking prior to the grand announcement.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We you'd have to believe it was a most active and highly contentious subject. It was not discussed. I don't remember a lecture on unification. I don't remember hearing anyone coming out of Ottawa down to us and saying, here are the glories of unification. But the rumors were rife, and we certainly kicked it around extensively, privately. And as you would expect from a combination of airmen, soldiers, and sailors, there were widely divergent views on I'd been up at the Chiefs of Staff Committee level, where the three services were working members of the three services were working as a single staff. And from my air transport command experience, I had considerable exposure to the Canadian Army, less to the Navy. So I had had a taste, if you like,
of
integration, cooperation. I had a great many friends in the Canadian Army. I knew how good or bad they were. So I had a... But, you see, many airmen, I don't think I'd ever seen a... Really, that's an overstatement, but had very little exposure to Army or Navy Canadians, and were full of apprehensions and the usual exaggerations and wild stories of how they conducted their affairs. I felt a little more informed, having worked closely with them. Over several years, and indeed my experience in at the RAF Staff College, where we worked very closely with the Army Staff College in Camberley and the Naval Staff College in Greenwich, all British, mind you, but I had broad exposure to the other services.
What were the arguments?
Well, was it good or bad, really? Was it going to improve the force? Was it going to achieve the alleged economies that would produce more equipment? Are we all going to have to get into one uniform? And mind you, now we were in 64, assuming that the average chap had been in the service since the late 30s, early 40s, the average experience was some 25 years. And here we were at the colonel, captain, group captain level in the case of the Canadian services. So our exposure had been, we were
old hands.
We were old, experienced hands with prospects of going higher. And I suppose there was the persistent fear that the farm would be sold for one service or another. And all of that came up. But I don't recall any particularly hot blood about it. That came later, when unification became a fact. We were still discussing it in a fairly academic way, and not absolutely certain that it was going to happen. We knew that studies were underway, but we weren't certain at that point in time that anything would be done. It was being examined.
Did any of your colleagues come to mind feel their back against the wall and were going to come out fighting tooth and nail?
I didn't sense that then. We had a naval, an RCN Commodore, who was our class senior, in fact, and John Charles lives just down the road here,
Charles.
in Victoria now. And... three naval captains, four or five army colonels, and same group of airmen at the group captain level. I don't recall any bad blood coming out of the kind of discussions we had then. That happy event was to occur a little further down the line. It never did happen to me. I'll say now, even further down the line, when I worked for Navy and Army directly, and later on when I was posted to Mobile Command to be the senior airman under an army commander, in a green uniform. But to go back to your question, no particular heat that I recall.
What about the, I guess one of the primary importance that I see of NDC and Staff College, well, especially NDC with the Tri-Service, of developing the friendships, if you will. You're all, as you said, you're all 25-year experience, senior hands, going places, otherwise you wouldn't be there in the first place.
Theoretically. Yeah.
There's always exceptions to prove every rule, of course. Going to be working, these people are going to keep turning up, if you will, and friendships and the old boy net. I hate using that phrase particularly.
Well, but it's real. Every working system has an old boy net. I think it's inescapable. The relationships, we were mature, experienced senior officers. What was I at the time? I guess I was 42, was I? In 1964, 40, 42, 43. And the rest were of that age, some younger, some older, but that was the mean age, I suppose, 43. The 11th month exposure at NDC, at that stage of one's career, resulted in the formation of very special relationships that you got to a certain extent at any year's course earlier on, but it was earlier on.
It would be more camaraderie, wouldn't it? As
well, no. Although you formed relationships there, but it tended to be a single service relationship. This here now, you were breaking out interdepartmentally, if you mm-hmm. like. And I know that when I was posted to Ottawa after NDC, as was most of my course, the relationships, the associations, that the friendships that had formed during the 11 month at NDC proved very, very useful to me in the conduct of my business mm-hmm. later on, and that continues really until this day. Not many, perhaps, but three or four particularly close friends, in whom you had complete confidence and expected, indeed demanded, the absolute truth from them, and felt that you were getting a straight answer when you wanted the facts on a particular situation. It's a feature of NDC, and I expect of any similar institution in other nations that you do form there a significant relationship that lasts and professionally is very, very useful, extraordinarily useful.
You leave NDC in what, late 64, 65?
No, NDC, I,